Taking Stock.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
Well, hello everyone and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes-Culleton and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. So coming up on today's show, why do Irish people listen to so much music? We look at new statistics that show Irish people are king and queen of music downloads and streams. We look at how Ozempic is changing more than just waistlines and how its economic effects go all the way to hospitality, travel and beyond. Plus,
money, it's a gas. Grab that cash with both hands and make a stash.
We talk cash. A new book called The Power of Cash argues that we really need to keep tangible money alive. Now, you can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on social media. I'm on LinkedIn, X, Instagram and Blue Sky at Susan Hayes Culleton. Now, I want to start off this week by explaining the idea of the velocity of money. I was out for breakfast last weekend with my dad in Macroom, and there was lots of references to local suppliers and people often encourage shopping local. So I want to tell you why. So imagine this story. A man walks into a B&B and he asks if they have any vacancies, and the B&B owner says they do. But then the man says, well, he has to look at the room first. And the B&B owner says, right, but you have to give me a deposit of €50 while you're doing so. So he does. And then with that €50, the B&B owner goes across to the florist and says, here's the money that I owe you. And then the florist goes to the vegetable shop and says, here's the money I owe you. And then the person who owns the vegetable shop goes back to the B&B and says, here's the money that I owed you. So at this stage, we've now had four different transactions. And then the person comes back down the stairs in the B&B and says, actually, I'm after getting a call and I have to go home. So I'm actually not going to stay here. And then the B&B owner hands the money back to that person. Think about it. The money moved right around. Everybody got paid, but actually there was no net money created. And that is what the velocity of money is all about. Economic growth isn't just about how much we spend, but how quickly we spend it. And the velocity of money shows that. So when you do spend money in your local environment and when that money moves quickly throughout that local environment, that is the real power of shopping local. So in summary, the velocity of money is the speed at which people spend and it's what really underpins the power of shopping local. Now, music streaming services like Spotify have transformed how people access and enjoy music globally. And of course, that is also the way in which people can listen to this show. Now, in Europe particularly and in Ireland and in Scandinavian countries, these platforms are widely used. And I spotted a tweet from Eurostat recently that caught my eye. In Ireland, 82.1% of individuals use the internet in the past 3 months before the survey to listen to or download music. That was the highest of all of the EU. So we're now joined by arts journalist and author Aoife Barry to get some insight into consumer behaviour, market trends and the evolving digital music economy. Aoife, first of all, thanks a million for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So in Ireland, the digital music market is big business and Statista projects that it'll reach about $138 million this year. Streaming contributed about 7 in every 10 euro of worldwide recorded music revenue last year, and 2024 was the 10th straight year of global music revenue growth. So can you give us a tour around the industry, please, Aoife?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's a massive industry. I mean, if you're looking at Spotify, it's basically kind of the most dominant, really, music service. And people think about music streaming. It was founded in 2006 and it's grown its active monthly users hugely since that time to 675 million people around the world. So that shows you the kind of interest in streaming music online or streaming in general, because as we'll get to, Spotify isn't just about music. And that particular app has got 31% market share, and, like, you know, 263 million of its users also pay for a subscription. So it's got what's called a freemium model, which is what a lot of these music streaming models have, where across these models, people can actually listen to it without paying anything and they get ads, or else they have paying customers, and the paying customers at Spotify, for example, are 263 million of them, and then they don't get ads and they kind of have their subscriptions there, and they might have different options depending on how much they actually pay. And if you look kind of globally at, like, streaming and how much it makes up of the global music industry, there was a report by the International Federation of the Phonographic Industry, IFPI, and it showed that in the last count, music industry revenue had doubled to 29.6 billion since 2014. So that's brilliant to see, because the music industry had major issues in the early 2000s because of, you know, illegal downloads, etc. And streaming now accounts for 69% of the kind of listening that's done within the music industry in terms of revenue. 69% of that, 29.6 billion is revenue that's accounted to streaming. So if you look back, we'll say at 2014, the music industry was worth 14 billion. So you can see how much it's jumped. It's nearly doubled since then. And back then you're looking at compact discs being the main source of income there, but now it's streaming. So it's really massive. I mean, so there might be people listening to this now who can't imagine any other way of encountering or listening to music than streaming it. And even people who do listen to, you know, vinyl and CDs, digital streaming will be a huge part of their lives, whether they use Apple Music or Deezer or Spotify or any of the other options that are out there.
Now, you're a numbers woman like myself, Aoife, so I'm going to delve right into one of them, right? You spoke there about how there's around about 263 million premium subscribers for Spotify. And yeah, when I looked into the earnings call, the last earnings call that they had, and just for listeners who aren't familiar with what it is, it's a quarterly webinar that a company listed on the stock market like Spotify has to have with people who are interested in knowing what's going on in the business. And 90% of the revenue, Aoife, came from those 260 odd million premium subscribers, with another 400 million odd that are ad supported subscribers. So just like you were saying, they're listening for free. They're hearing an ad from time to time. Is that business model sustainable for a start? And secondly, is there any way to compete against those types of numbers if you're looking to be an incumbent in the industry?
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? You know, because if you're looking at that, if you're looking at things like ad listeners who are willing to listen to, you know, Spotify, for example, or music streamer, and are willing to kind of sit through the ads, what you're trying to do as a business is like convert as many of those people as you possibly can to actually paying for them. And that can be an actual kind of tricky job. And the numbers aren't really showing that Spotify is massively kind of increasing those kind of, subscription listeners at a very, very high rate or anything like that. You know, most of the listeners tend to be, you know, those people who are the ad supported listeners. So even though Spotify is growing, an issue for it is kind of converting those people over. And if you look at something like its average revenue that it gets for every user, that's also been declining a small amount too. So this is a really big challenge. And what Spotify in particular has been doing is trying to kind of add new incentives on for people to pay for subscriptions. So that's really the key for the companies, you know, who are in this industry and in this area, is how much can we offer that's good for us, but that we can offer to our users so that we can tempt them into paying. So for example, if you want to access audiobooks on Spotify, which is a new part of its package, then you're going to have to pay more to do that. If you want to listen to podcasts, you're going to have to pay more to do that. If you're going to want to listen without ads, obviously you're going to be paying more to do that. So what it's basically trying to do is give people more reasons to pay the money. There's also things like it has a particular area on Spotify you can go to now that'll tell you about upcoming releases, and you can click a button on that when you're a subscriber, and it will automatically kind of put the new release into your playlist so that you have it there on the day when it arrives. So it's trying to make life easier for its people who are willing to pay subscription fees. And there's different tiers of subscriptions, and the money that you're paying for subscriptions is going up as well. So that's another way the companies are trying to make money, is pay more for a subscription. So even if we aren't growing that number of people, we're still growing the numbers that people are actually paying, if that makes sense. But it's a tough industry, because people are used to listening to music for free. Starting in the, you know, downloading era, people were kind of getting used to accessing music for free. And there is an attitude among a lot of people of like, why would I pay for something I can sit through a few ads? It's like listening to the radio. So it's a very tricky thing to try to do. So that's why they're trying to add more things on to get more people willing to pay that money to get that exclusive content.
Well, Aoife, when you say it's a tricky thing to do, I mean, if there's one thing can absolutely back up that claim, it is the fact that, and you mentioned Spotify is 19 years old this year, is that last year in 2024 was the first year it ever turned a full year net profit. Now, it was over a billion euro, which is, okay, a very significant one. But it has taken them 18 years to get to a point of having a full year net profit. And particularly that's driven by the fact that, in Spotify's case anyway, 70% of revenue is allocated from music rights holders. So can I ask you, for the people who are listening today and say, oh God, that's great, 70% is great. So 70% of the amount that I'm paying for Spotify is going to local artists or the people that I'm listening to. Is that the case, or how does Spotify distribute the money among its artists?
So this is where we get into the interesting and tricky and kind of difficult to explain element of it. But basically, people will think that if you listen to an album on Spotify by Joe Bloggs, that Joe Bloggs will open their post a month later and there'll be a nice check in there. Or maybe they'll look at their bank account online and there'll be, you know, X amount of money from Spotify for, you know, the million streams that you had. But that's not actually how it works. It works on a stream share basis. And it also, and I'll explain that in a second, but also how it works is that it's the rights holders that are getting paid. So it's not like the artist getting paid into their bank account. You're thinking about their labels, for example, or the people that hold the rights to the actual composition of the songs. So you're talking about it being distributed through, for example, a company like Universal. If you are a Universal signed artist, they will be having the deal with Spotify. They will get paid, and then that money essentially will trickle down to the artist. So it's a really kind of tricky one. And also the tracks, if you're going to be paid royalties, you must reach at least 1,000 listens in 12 months to become eligible for royalties. So really, if you're someone who's not going to get a huge amount of listens anyway, you can't really be even adding up the pennies there. And I was talking about the stream share a second ago as well. So basically, if an artist's catalogue accounts for 1% of total streams, it'll earn 1% of total royalties. So we're, again, like you could see, we're not talking about pennies per track. It's a lot more nuanced than that. And that does mean that some people are going to make a lot of money. There's 200 artists each that generate around $5 million a year from Spotify. And again, I say generate because, you know, the money can be kind of, you know, there could be cuts taken off there with their labels and things like that. And around the top 70 acts generate at least $10 million each. But can you imagine the plays that have to go into it to be someone who's generating that amount of money and to be one of the top 70 acts? You're talking about millions upon millions, if not billions, of streams.
Like, it really has changed the game entirely, hasn't it? Totally and utterly. I want to ask you about the algorithm, right? Because a lot of people complain about the fact that, you know, tech companies are taking the information that we're giving them and giving us things back that are very tailored. But I do want to ask you about the Discover Weekly playlist. And now, I have to say, I wasn't aware of this until I actually went researching this. But when the Discover Weekly playlist came out, so just for people who aren't familiar, like I was, it's a custom playlist delivered every Monday for each user, and it was streamed 2.3 billion times in its first year of existence. And when I put it on in preparation to talk to you today, Aoife, it was brilliant. Like, it was right up my street. So is one of the things that Spotify and its respective competitors doing really well is their ability to give to us what we want to listen to?
Yeah, I mean, that's what you're talking about there, really, is personalization. And that is one of the absolute keys to the success to these companies, is that particularly, again, and I keep going back to Spotify, but that's because it's the biggest company, and Irish people in particular use Spotify a lot. It really cottoned onto this idea of personalization. So using the algorithm, seeing what people tend to be driven towards listening to themselves, what songs they tend to like, what albums they tend to be driven to, what they might like when they're kind of, you know, served up options on Discover Weekly or whatever, to guide them towards a general sound or albums or artists that they think that people will like. So like, that is why people go back to it. You know, I know myself, if I look at my Spotify, if I look at something like Discover Weekly or any of the playlists that I might have put together for me, it will generally really be spot on with my music taste. So it will know what I'm most likely to listen to. It's not going to be serving me up like, you know, Sabrina Carpenter or something, because that's just not something I listen to. But at the same time, what that can do is, you know, tie people within a kind of a bubble. It means you're less likely to be looking outside of those genres that it's serving you up, which is why people who would be kind of, you know, opposed to people being fully on these digital services would say it's really important to be seeking out music outside of the digital realm. And I believe that myself. I always try and buy, you know, music myself that is on CD or vinyl, because that is where I'll make my actual discoveries. Mm-hmm. Whereas Spotify is serving you up what it wants you to hear. And let's not forget as well, I mean, there's a book by Liz Pelly called Mood Machine, which is well worth reading, about Spotify, which looks into how Spotify is, you know, serving up artists that, for example, might have paid to be positioned in certain places. Like, it's not a surprise that some artists are appearing regularly on certain playlists, and also how Spotify, you know, realized that people were really into listening to playlists, and particularly listening to chill out playlists and kind of relaxed playlists where they didn't really necessarily care, so Spotify thought, care who the artists were. And so Spotify began replacing some artists with essentially stock music that it was paying to have created. So there's a lot of stuff going on in the background. It might just seem like, oh, this app is handing me what I want to listen to, Neil Young 24/7. But actually what it's doing is, you know, it's trying to make money, trying to keep you in the app. And it's also trying to figure out ways for it to pay less amounts of royalties to people while still serving out music. That's where you get things like that, you know, that what's called the perfect fit content, which is that instrumental music to populate playlists instead of actual artists that will have to pay more money to. So I would recommend Mood Machine, that book by Liz Pelly, if people want to learn more about that specific area.
Well, you know what? I feel, Aoife, that I've actually learned an awful lot, not just about you, but about your music interests during this conversation. I don't have time to ask you about this, but there is just one statistic that I want to finish our conversation on today, and that is 84% in 2024, 84% of songs that reach the Billboard's Global 200 chart have gone viral on TikTok first. Two-thirds of music listeners on TikTok are paying users of at least one streaming service. And it does seem to be that TikTok virality is now one of the strongest predictors of a song's global success. So maybe in a future conversation, Aoife, we'd love to have you back on to talk about that, to see if TikTok really is the cart before the horse. But on that note, I'm going to have to bring our conversation to an end today. Aoife Barry, thank you so much indeed for joining us.
Thanks a million.
This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we're going to talk about the power of cash. This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk, and you're very welcome back. Now, what I want to do is share some messages with you from listeners over the past couple of weeks. So first of all, we've had one in here from Larissa, and she was talking about how she really has found a lot of interest and a lot of insight from following earnings calls, particularly picking up on the Magnificent Seven conversation that we had a little while ago. We also have a message in here from Jacqueline, who says that she's really enjoying the broad nature of the show. And Jacqueline, that is about to continue for sure. And also, I want to say hello to Niamh and particularly her mother as well. One of our most enthusiastic listeners. Really want to say thanks a million for the lovely support that you have shared with me on WhatsApp messages over the past couple of weeks. Thanks a million. So when was the last time you used paper money or cash to pay for anything? Even getting a can from a vending machine can now be done with a tap. Is this convenience a good thing? Well, my next guest's latest book argues the rise of the cashless society has left us willing to pay more and appreciate less what we do when we make a purchase. So it's great to welcome Professor Jay Zagorski from Boston University Questrom School of Business and author of The Power of Cash to the show. You're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Thank you for having me on the show, Susan.
Well, I really enjoyed the book, I have to say, and there was a lot of things in it that I expected, but there was several that I didn't. For example, you quoted something from your own research that said that the vast number of people underestimated their financial situation and that the average person believed that they only had 62 cents for every $1 of wealth they actually held. And you attributed that to people having held more of their wealth in electronic format rather than in paper format. Now, I would have thought that was surely the other way around, because I can see a balance immediately in my account rather than estimating how much cash and coins I have.
You know, Susan, wealth is held in many different forms. Sometimes it's held in housing. Sometimes it's held in stocks or bonds or shares. Sometimes it's held in jewelry. So it's very hard for people actually to estimate how much they're really worth. But estimating how much you're really worth is really important, because if you overestimate, then you're going to be spending a bit like crazy and your friends will be like, you don't have any money. Why are you spending like this? And if you underestimate, then there's all these wonderful things you could do in the world that you could probably afford, but you're not spending enough because you don't think you actually have the money.
And is it not easier, though, to see how much things are? Like you mentioned there, for example, stocks and bonds. I can log into my account and I can see how much they're worth. But on the other hand, if it's something like jewellery, for example, well, obviously then that's illiquid, or I would have to go and find a buyer. So why is it that people who hold cash actually have a better sense of what they actually have, since it's paper?
One of the easiest things with cash is that when I open my wallet, I can see how I'm doing and how many days I have left until payday. It's very, very straightforward. If I'm looking at the bank, well, occasionally I have a bill queued up and I don't know, oh, is that going to be paid tomorrow? Is it going to be paid 2 days from now? I don't really remember. But with cash, it's a very easy and tactile method of knowing financially, am I doing okay right now? And can I go out for, say, dinner or for lunch? Or am I need to be economizing it just a little bit?
Well, I found myself fighting with you right throughout chapter 3 to chapter 8. Because you said that there are three things that we need to make electronic payments, and they are electricity, secure computers, and a network communication system. And the reason that I was fighting with you all the time was because I felt that, but sure, most of the time they work, like the vast, vast, vast majority of times that they work. And your primary point was, first, what happens if they don't? And secondly, it's a cyber threat. But I have to say, as I went through those chapters, I found myself agreeing with you because you put forward very easily retainable scenarios. For example, the great freeze in Austin when power went down. And of course, as I was reading the book, I was reflecting on the power shortage that happened in Portugal and Spain. And obviously, we can bring up certain cybersecurity attacks, etc. So could you tell us, now that I'm on your side on this, right, tell us how vulnerable the assumptions are that electricity, secure computers and network communication systems all need to work all the time in order to make sure electronic payments happen safely and securely?
So over in the UK, just a couple of days ago, they had a massive number of cyber incidents. For example, there's a large supermarket chain called the Co-op, and they can't accept electronic payments. Maybe by the time your listeners hear it, it's going to be available. But right now, they're cash only. About a week earlier, all of Spain, all of Portugal, and a little bit of southern France all went down for over a day, the entire electricity network. 2 weeks before that, the entire island of Puerto Rico went down. I'm not saying that you need to use cash all the time. My answer is very simple, or my quest is very simple. Just get people to use cash once or twice a week. As long as you keep it going in circulation, as long as you have it in your wallet or purse, as long as you're able to understand how to use it and shops are able to understand how to use it, then we're protected from when all these things happen.
And that came through very much in the book, is that you're not saying down with this sort of thing when it comes to electronic payments, but more so that cash can help people to become more resilient. But can we just look across the demographic spectrum here for a moment? Because you said among 18 to 34 year olds, half don't carry cash, while one quarter of those over 55 still rely on it. So how do generational differences shape attitudes towards cash and digital payments?
I'm actually very worried. I think I have a pretty good chance of convincing older people to continue using cash. A lot of older people read the book and they go, yeah, yeah. I have a number of students I teach at the university. A number of students who are 20, 22, 23, and they're like, never use cash. And some have read the book and said, well, I might carry cash every now and then, but you still didn't really convince me. So my big concern is the younger generation. And older people, well, they grew up with cash. I remember going to school when I was in elementary school, I had to bring lunch money every day. I had to stop at the, I didn't have to, but I wanted to stop off and get some candy on the way home. I use cash all the time. Today, young children and teenagers just don't use cash anymore. So while I think I can convince older generations to continue using cash, I'm very worried about trying to figure out how to convince younger generations.
But is that just because it's what everybody does in the same way that you grew up in the way that you grew up where you used cash all the time? So is it less about a choice necessarily that people are consciously making and more about just what people do?
It's not so much what people do. There are incredible financial incentives for banks and other finance companies to get you to use electronic payments. If you use cash, they don't make any money. If you swipe, tap, use mobile payments, somebody's getting somewhere between 1% and up to 6% of that purchase. And they try and encourage all of us to use electronic payments by doing advertising. Here in the United States, last year, there was over $1 billion of advertising for credit cards. The amount of advertising for cash, zero. Advertising is incredibly effective. If you keep seeing ads over and over again, swipe, tap, use mobile payments, use some type of financial technology product, you're just going to believe that that's the best thing.
Well, if we could maybe bring that geographical lens closer to where I am at the moment, and that is, I found it really striking that people in the Eurozone are three times more likely or use three times as much cash as people in the UK. Why is that?
That I don't know. It's very, very hard to understand why countries, some use cash and some don't. Quick example, Netherlands versus Germany. The Germans love using cash. The people in the Netherlands, not so much. I was in the Netherlands a couple of months ago, and I went to take a ferry across a river. It was 1 euro. I pulled out a 1 euro coin, and the boatman looked at me and said, no. I was like, no? He goes, credit card, debit card. It's like, it's 1 euro. I said, why are you not accepting? He goes, for safety reasons. And I'm thinking, there's probably only 10 of us on the boat. I mean, who's going to rob you of 10 euros? But, you know, I actually keep one credit card in reserve for these type of things. And I pulled it out and tapped it and he let me on the boat.
Well, I have to pick up on one story that you told that I found frightening. When you pick up about, or when you know there about safety reasons, because you talked about a group of researchers, primarily from MIT, mm-hmm. and they took 3 months worth of anonymous now being a key word here, anonymous credit card records for 1.1 million people, and they were able to re-identify 90% of those individuals legally. You said women and people who have more income are actually easier to re-identify. And then in that chapter, you walked us through the example of how you might actually be able to do that based on people who drink coffee in your own university, etc. What is it about our anonymous, I'll pick that word again, anonymous electronic payments that makes us so identifiable?
Well, many of us use social media. And if you point out on social media, oh, I just bought these shoes, or I just went to dinner at this place, just all you have to do is one or two things. And I'm pretty much sure if I have a giant database of all credit card or debit card transactions, I can probably pick you out. Why? Because at the end of every single year, most of us get a statement from our banks saying, oh, you spent this much on transport, this much on gasoline, this much on food. And how do they know that? Because every transaction is coded. For example, if I fly on a plane, every single individual airline has their own special code. So if I say, oh, I'm flying on this plane, you know, say Ryanair, then I can easily find Ryanair. If I'm staying at some hotel in another place, so I flew Ryanair and I'm staying at, say, a Hilton Hotel, Hilton Hotels has their own code for the electronic funds network. And I could just put the two together and easily find you, even without your name.
I think that's slightly frightening. Because when I was reading through this in the book and even listening there now to your own explanation, I think we think that anonymous means unidentifiable. And it, particularly the way in which you describe it in the book, it's remarkably easy to whittle it right down. But during section three, I learned a lot about you, Zay. I learned a lot about you. And I'm going to quote this because it says it will inform our audience about you as well. So you said, some people in my family are aghast at how much I have spent on various bottles of wine, and others are insulted when I didn't spend enough on wine they were served. Paying with cash and throwing away the receipts solved both problems. So tell us, say, how does cash prevent problems in family relationships and social circles?
There's actually been a lot of research, and a large number of people, unfortunately, are not really totally in love with their spouse, or they trust their spouse. And here in the United States, we have problems of things like spouse abuse. And with that, a number of people are trying to sort of get away. But if you actually pull out your credit card and pay for, say, a lawyer to investigate divorce kind of things, then your spouse might actually get really infuriated and it might end up in even a worse situation than you're in. Using cash enables you to get out of an abusive relationship. I don't have an abusive relationship with my wife. We love each other very much. We've been together 40 years. And how did we make it? Because there are certain things she spends money on that I don't ask about. And I spend certain monies on things like wine that she doesn't ask about. And how do we do that? We both pay cash for those things. By doing that, she enjoys wine, but never gets aghast at you spent how much on that bottle. And when she wants to go out and buy things, say like shoes, I don't know. I smile. I say, they look very nice on you. Cash sometimes can improve relationships.
And we also learned in the book as well about your predilection for donuts and how your wife was warning you against them. But again, cash seemed to solve that problem as well. Can I also, there was one area that I wanted to challenge you on, and that was in table 10.2, right? It was in chapter 10. You said there's an estimate of a cash handling fee of 50 cents in comparison to credit cards of about $2.10 with transactions over $100. And again, for anybody who reads the book, you'll know that there was a couple of other parameters in there. And while I completely see how that's the case, Isn't it much more cost effective, particularly for businesses on the accounting side with electronic payments? Because whatever about handling the cash, that's one thing. But then actually accounting for it, you're completely minimizing error if you're using electronic payments. Is that not the case? So if we factor in the cost of accounting, would that not balance the books?
Well, let's talk about errors for a moment. I don't know about you, but I would say, and I don't use my credit or debit cards very much at all, say 3 or 4 times a year, I have to go fight with the credit card company because there's been an overcharge or the charge was the wrong amount or something like that. As a quick example, tomorrow night I'm staying in a hotel and I'm kind of unsure about that hotel because 4 months ago, they double charged me, that very hotel. I paid ahead of time. And then as I checked out, they double charged my credit card. And I probably spent about 20, 25 minutes dealing with both the credit card company and the hotel trying to get the charge reversed. So this idea that electronic payments are error-free just really doesn't exist. If I had paid cash, it wouldn't have taken any extra time on either the hotel's part or the bank's part. I would have paid the cash and I would have walked away.
There's loads more that I'd love to talk to you about on this book, but we are up against the clock at this point. So I really want to thank you very much indeed, Professor Jay Zagorski from Boston University Questrom School of Business and author of The Power of Cash.
Thanks for having me on the show, Susan.
This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we hear how Ozempic is changing economics. Welcome back to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton, and, well, Ozempic may be less than a year in circulation, but it has already become a cultural reference point. So its weight loss properties were seen immediately, but its effects on our wider health and even on our economic well-being have started to be discussed. So I'm really delighted to be joined by Ben Spencer, the science editor of The Times, who has just returned from a conference in Spain where the long-term effects of weight loss drugs were discussed. Ben, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be here.
Well, Ben, I'm going to lean on the piece that you wrote last week in The Times. And you noted that polling in the US suggests that 1 in 8 US adults, now that's 25 million people, have already taken the drugs. And following on from that then, last week, the US Food and Drug Administration, or the FDA, has shut down an emergency measure that allows pharmacies to sell copies of the most widely prescribed weight loss injection. So how prevalent do you think these medicines are around the world today?
Oh, it's massive. I mean, even that stat, 1 in 8 adults in the UK. I mean, I've been writing about drugs and weight loss and lifestyle for 15 years, and we've never seen anything like that, any kind of prevalence like that. They now think that this is actually bending the obesity curve in the US. So that means after decades of rises in obesity, that's now plateaued in the US. It's now starting to calm down as a result of these drugs, which I don't think anyone could have foreseen. I mean, these were designed for diabetes. I mean, they were designed by Novo Nordisk initially, which was a diabetes company. It made insulin for 100 years, and it designed this drug as another diabetes medicine. And suddenly, it's on an absolute gold mine because it's not just diabetes. It treats, it brings down obesity quite significantly. And now we're starting to see other effects. So it can be used to treat heart disease, strokes, addiction, all sorts.
But the weekly injections basically trick your brain into thinking that you're full. And does this then pose a risk to letting your body do the talking and let it ask for the nutrition that it needs rather than telling it to shut up?
Well, it's potentially. I mean, that's the other side of the story. These are incredibly powerful drugs. And the long-term effects aren't really known. So as with all drugs, there will be side effects. We're starting to see the short-term effects of those. We know that if you stop taking them, the weight comes back on quite quick, within 10 months, all of it.
Why, Ben? Why is that the case? Why is it that the weight can come back so quickly?
Well, this is basically tricking your brain, as you say, into thinking you're full when you're not. As soon as you stop taking it, you feel ravenous. That's what people say. The hunger comes back and then some. And not only that, but what people tend to lose muscle mass, not just fat. So they might be weaker than they were before, have more kind of joint problems, things like this. So, I mean, these are really powerful drugs. And we're only just beginning to see what the side effects are.
Okay, you mentioned earlier on about bending the obesity curve. And I think it would be a good idea just to give our listeners a sense of what that really means, because over a billion people globally are expected to be living with obesity by 2030. And that's roughly doubling the 2010 figure. And according to the BBC, nearly one in three adults in England is obese today. So could these drugs spell the end of diabetes, dramatically reduce heart attacks? Like, could there be really, really positive medicinal outcomes?
Yeah, I mean, lots and lots of conditions are linked to being overweight. So you've got the obvious ones, right? So you've got type 2 diabetes, you've got heart disease, and then you've got things that aren't so obvious, like mental health problems, you've got arthritis, joint problems. There's cancers. Quite a lot of cancers are linked to being overweight. So if you can reduce the obesity burden, you can have a big impact on the on people's health. Now, there's also unintended consequences from that. I mean, people have got to die of something, right? So you might get, if people aren't being killed by heart disease in old age, we might see a real boom in dementia, for example. I'm just kind of speculating as to what the unintended consequences could be. But that's something that people talk about. Yes, you might have fewer people in hospital for these weight-related conditions, but you might, as people get older, as the longevity increases, they might be coming in with other conditions which are harder to treat. There's also an impact economically. I talked a little bit in my piece about impact on restaurants, impact on gyms, impact on society. You know, food is a big bonding a tool in our society. It's something, you know, people gather around a dinner table for family meals. We celebrate with food. We celebrate with drink. And these drugs make people not want to drink as much. So it could really have social impacts that we can't even foresee yet.
Let's stick with the food and the drink. Well, actually, no. I'll delve into the drink side of things for a moment. And not the social side, I just mean actually the drinking itself. Because I found a Morgan Stanley research study that said obesity drug patients reported cutting back considerably on both non-alcoholic and alcoholic beverages. 65% of people consuming fewer sugary carbonated drinks and 62% of people drinking less alcohol, and nearly a quarter stopped drinking altogether. Do you think, Ben, are we on the precipice of having the ability to medicate away cravings that can be behind addiction to substances?
I think that's certainly the potential of these drugs. A lot of this is not yet proven, but that's certainly the potential, and that's the theory. And it's not just addiction to obvious things like drinking or smoking. People are talking about using this to combat gambling addiction, which is fascinating.
But how could that be the case? Because gambling isn't a substance.
No, but it's the addiction, it's that craving, it's that unmitigated, it's that urge to do something you know is bad for you. I mean, addiction is a complex disease, a complex social disease, as well as a psychological disease. And we don't frankly know quite how these drugs do this. But there's something about the way they change the chemistry of our brains, which doesn't just make us want to eat less, it makes us want to do less of the things that we have urges to do. And neurologists aren't quite sure why, but there's a pretty growing, solid but growing evidence base for this.
So let's circle back, as they say, to the point of view then of looking at this as a public health issue. Because if we, like, one of the things about any of these drugs is that they are really, really expensive. And particularly, as I say, the development that happened last week makes that even more so. I saw a professor in Glasgow University worked out the maths on this. And it's estimated that it costs the NHS about £3,000 a year to give a patient either a Mounjaro or Wegovy. So if everyone eligible in England received them right now, that would be about £10 billion annually. And that would be half the entire NHS drugs budget. So what is though, but if we think about all of the good things that you've said around, you know, heart disease and so on like that, what's the cost-benefit analysis of these drugs from a public purse point of view then?
Well, they think, there was a study published a couple of weeks ago which estimated it would boost the economy simply by reducing 6 days and simply for obesity and diabetes. So forget all the other impacts we've talked about, beneficial impacts we've talked about. Simply by reducing those 6 days for obesity and type 2 diabetes, it would improve the economy by £4.5 billion a year. That is a not insubstantial amount. However, the NHS in England doesn't have a lot of cash at the moment. Its woes are well documented. So what they've decided to do is roll this out bit by bit. So at the moment, 50,000 people in the UK are getting it. That's due to increase to about 4 million over the next 12 years. Gradually, they will roll it out to more and more people, simply because they don't have the cash flow, irrespective of long-term impact. They don't have the cash flow at the moment or the resources, the prescribing resources, to get it out to people. There's also another factor that we haven't talked about, which is that not all GPs, or the gatekeepers to these drugs, are into it. A lot, there's this big feeling that obesity is something you do to yourself, and that rather than injecting yourself, you should go on a diet and go for a run. And that's this prevention kind of agenda is very strong amongst GPs who don't all like these drugs.
Now, if you're just joining us, I'm talking to Ben Spencer, science editor of The Times, where we're talking about injectable weight loss drugs and a really big economic changes that we're seeing coming down the tracks as a result of them. Ben, can I take that point that you make, though, about obesity being something that can be, as you say, whether it's about dieting and exercising, lots of people who suffer from obesity would argue with that and say it's not just willpower, it's biology. And particularly, and you mentioned it or you quoted it in your own piece, there's people who can't lose weight any other way. So therefore, is there then is it a social issue? Is it a morality issue? Is it an ethics issue? Is it an education issue? What do you think needs to happen then to bring this conversation right and under the spotlight so that the right outcomes happen for the right people in the right places?
Well, there's no doubt that decades of the prevention agenda have not worked. That's just without dispute. So we've got a growing obesity crisis. In the UK, nearly two-thirds of adults are overweight. In school, children about one in five children arrive at primary school at age 4 or 5 overweight. And when they leave primary school age 11, about a third are overweight. I mean, that is not small numbers. We've been talking about 5 a day for what? 20 years, barely anyone has their 5 a day. We've been talking about 150 minutes of exercise that people should have a week, probably for as long, barely anyone does it. That's not to say they shouldn't, but if we're talking about being pragmatic and simply what is working on a public health scale, the prevention agenda just hasn't worked. Now, obviously, we don't want to over-medicalize society. We don't want to treat people with drugs when there are really powerful and expensive drugs, as I said before, when there are other obvious, proven routes to achieving the same goal. But if they're not working at a population level, then there's a strong argument for looking again. And these drugs are doing things that no one has been able to achieve in another way. Now, as I say, that's not to say there aren't side effects to that. So I don't think we're yet at the point of saying, let's roll them out to everyone. These are still very much on an NHS point of view, for people who are very obese with clinical repercussions, so heart disease and type 2 diabetes. You can get them privately if you are overweight or obese without other health conditions, and you can pay out of your pocket for that, 200 quid a month. But you can't get them on the NHS yet unless you've got other health conditions.
As we come to the end of our conversation, Ben, I'd just like to look at the wider economics of this as well. I went to Weight Watchers years ago, and I about 15 years ago, and I really found it very good from an educational perspective, actually, on food and nutrition. And you mentioned in your piece that Weight Watchers is now filed for bankruptcy in the US this month after losing nearly a third of its customers last year. You mentioned earlier on about restaurants might need to change, you know, gyms, the broader wellness industry. What do you think these industries need to be considerate of? Is it portion size? Is it encouraging people, if they are going to come off the drugs, to maintain a healthy exercise? Now, what do you see the wider economics being, and what should industries be thinking about today to prepare for that?
Yeah, it's difficult for them because it's almost like a tale of two societies. There's this growing group of people who don't want to, who are taking these drugs and don't really want to eat. And there's some restaurants which have already tried to address that by adjusting their menus with less fatty options, more healthy options, smaller portion sizes. But at the same time, the problem driving this is that the rest of us still want big portions of kind of instant gratification food. We've got gyms which are kind of focusing on promoting muscle retention for people on these drugs. We've got health spas which are focusing less on weight loss now, more on longevity, because increasing numbers of their customers are on these drugs. So we're going to see impact all over the economy as the uptake increases. As I say, an eighth of people in the US, that's not a small number. We're nowhere near that in the British Isles yet, but it's growing and it will continue to grow.
Well, Ben, I mean, you've given us some startling numbers there, from the $4.5 billion a year that could be saved, from the 50,000 people in the UK that could go up to 4 million, to the 1 in 8 adults that have tried it in the US, etc. It's going to be a topic I'm sure we'll be looking at on many times. So thanks so much indeed for joining me, Ben Spencer, the science editor of The Times. And so that's it for this week's Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes-Cullerton. I really hope you enjoyed the show and that you enjoyed learning something about economics and how it affects our world. Now, I just want to remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. And please do subscribe to the show while you're there and pass the podcast on to people in your WhatsApp groups as well, if it's of interest to you. It's also on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. And the producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy. And on research this week was Stephen Daunt and Simon Keane. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. And thank you so much for listening, and enjoy the rest of your day. I look forward to talking to you again next week.